You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 256. Hello and welcome to the Punk News Podcast. My name is Adam White. I'm recording for you in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Joining me on tonight's show, for the duration of the show for sure, Mr. Ricky Frankel out of Los Angeles. Hi, Ricky.
Hey, Adam. How's it going, guys?
I'm going well. And guys is referring to the person we haven't announced. And it's really not a super surprise. It's John Gentile, but he is potentially not here. And I don't even know where you are. John, where are you and why?
I am in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, which is kind of near Harrisburg, and it is in the middle of nowhere. And I'm a businessman, Adam White. I'm a businessman. I'm out here doing business. Business.
There's a lot of, like, business ambient noise happening around you. Are you in an airport, or?
I'm at a Panera Bread, and there's a bunch of cars driving past me, but the Panera is closing pretty soon, so I don't think we'll have to deal with that. But listen, I'm going to ride the mute button really hard so you don't get much background noise.
So are you like hanging out in like the stock room or something? Like,
no, I'm actually outside. Like, they've got chairs and stuff outside the Panera. I don't want to sit in the Panera and do the podcast because then people think I'm a real lunatic. So I bought a $2 Arnold Palmer iced tea again on the Punk News Podcast. And I'm sitting outside doing the Punk News Podcast, and actually it's raining right now. So I'm doing the podcast outside of a Panera Bread in the rain. That is how much I am dedicated to you, the Punk News listener.
That's entirely something that you didn't need to be doing. But hey, anyways, also apparently joining me on tonight's show is my like 2-month-old son, who at some point is going to be sleeping on the floor next to me as I record this. So that might interrupt us. So yeah, we're just going to roll with it this week and see what happens. As you heard from the theme music that brought us in this week, this is a Descendants week. We have some news about the Descendants. And I don't know if we want too much preamble. We should probably just jump into this one and talk about this because, I mean, it's pretty big news, but there's not a lot of details at this moment. But you know, in a very brief social media post, Stephen Egerton of the Descendants posted that the band is currently working on new material. That is all that we know at this point. This is going to be the follow-up to Cool to Be You, which came out in 2004 on Fat. Was it on Fat or Epitaph?
Fat.
I'm going to say Fat. Which was itself the follow-up to 1996's Everything Sucks, and that one I was, I think, on Epitaph. This kind of works with the Descendants, like, 10-year record and release cycle that they, you know, they seem like they're in. But John, when this story posted, there was an interesting little detail that came up with it, and the kids that read the site didn't quite get what it was when you mentioned it in the story. You want to chime in? Let us know.
Yeah. Well, first of all, now I am amazed, and this is a phenomenon of the past 2 or 3 years. Back when I was a young little punk rock, I was actually never a young punk rocker. I got into punk rock at like 18 or 19.
You emerged from a pod as a fully grown man.
I emerged from the punk pod as a fully metamorphized punk. I mean, like, when I got into punk, I feel as though I already knew a lot about punk. But back in the day, kids would never, ever admit that they don't know something. Like you said, oh, yeah, man, have you heard this Rare Amoebix bootleg? Someone would be like, of course I've heard the Rare Amoebix bootleg. Or if you bring up Crass to somebody, they would say, oh, my favorite Crass album is Yes, Sir, I Will, track 5. Like no one would ever admit to not knowing something about punk rock. Now the kids quite proudly proclaim that they don't know references about punk rock. They quite proudly proclaim that they don't know punk rock history. They quite proudly proclaim they don't care about the original punks, the early punks, the groundbreaking punks. And I guess that's kind of punk in itself, and, you know, tearing down your heroes, which I don't agree with, but tearing down your heroes, destroying the past, only focusing on the present. From a certain perspective, that is a punk rock ideal. And now, so more than ever, the kids don't know about their punk history and they're proud of it, which I find is interesting. And here's how this ties into the conversation. In the Instagram and Facebook post for the Descendants recording new material, which Punk News broke, mind you, there was a picture of some candy wrappers. And so I put on – and the article said had me putting on Facebook, Stephen Egerton said the Senators are recording new materials. He also included a bunch of pictures of some used candy wrappers, eating candy wrappers. And the kids are like, John, you're an idiot. Why would you post that? That doesn't mean anything. John, what the hell are you talking about? Those kids, little did they know that – the Descendants, when they record, they do two things. They drink lots of caffeine and they eat lots of sugar. I don't know if they really do that now, but they usually do it when they're younger. And so that idea has come through, that they still reference it in their songs. So they actually call it – is it called Myage when they do that? They call it something when they drink a whole bunch of coffee and eat a whole bunch of candy before recording. And so I put that in there as a reference to the legendary and famous mindset of the Descendants when they're recording. But the kids assaulted me saying, why am I posting that? I'm not doing a good job posting news, because they didn't know that. Adam, I was accused of being wrong because I knew my punk rock history and they didn't. And there was more of them than me. And I didn't really fight with them that too much. I just get really annoyed.
I think you may be taking their barbs a little bit hard, but, you know... well, I guess we should maybe first talk about, are you talking about the philosophical undertakings of the all philosophy here?
Yes, that's it. It's the all philosophy.
I don't know if it's maybe expecting too much for them to get the candy wrapper. I mean, the candy wrapper reference.
But that's like one of the big things on the first album. Like there's like three big things on the first album. There's Bikage. There's what's the song? Who's gonna be home to pick you up? Well, not me. What song is that? Is that Bikage?
Off the top of my head, I'm blanking. So
and then there's coffee. Hell, the cover of their first EP is a giant coffee cup. Not to mention their first EP has a song about coffee and eating candy. It's kind of like Descendants 101, the coffee and candy bar thing.
No. I mean, I get that. It just, you know, you gotta be nice to the. Well, to the youngins, to ease them into it. But I get what you mean, because they seemed kind of offended that you mentioned this reference. And I think that's what you're getting at. It's not so much that they didn't get it.
I was going to explain it, but then I'm like, you know, if I explain it, then they'll reprimand me, if you will, for explaining the obvious. So I didn't explain the obvious, and then they reprimanded me for not explaining the obvious. I didn't want to get into too deep with them. My retort was going to be, if I put up a picture of the Misfits, would I explain why they have devil locks? But, you know, you can't argue with idiots. Not that the punk news readership is idiots. I take that back. We have 7 idiots on the website and 49,993 nice, intelligent, good-looking people.
That is a very nice walk back. All right. So, anyways, despite the candy bar controversy, which I don't know, which like isn't really all that important, I guess. This is really exciting. There's new Descendants material coming out.
Adam, I have to interrupt. Yeah. I like how we're talking about one of the most important bands in punk rock, and our focus of the discussion is me fighting with trolls on the punk news comments.
Because that's just that's sort of what punk rock is these days, is John Gentile fighting with trolls. I mean, does New Descendants material matter to you guys? I mean, are they still a band that's recording stuff that feels vital, or are they old people now? I mean, I have my opinion on this, but I'm curious to see what you think.
You know, I mean, I've been slowly over I, for some reason, they were a band I never really that they were never really like attracting me to the music. It's been a long process for me to not necessarily. Like I appreciate their stance and their history in punk rock. I get that, but for some reason I just couldn't connect with the music until I really started like focusing and getting into the music a lot more and just forcing myself to listen. And I gotta tell you, I'm after the past few months, I've been really getting into like, I really liked Cool to Be You, and I love their whole, I love the, I really like the catalog, but Cool to Be You, their last one, just, I don't know, that just, there's so many things on that album that are just so relatable, and I think that's what their fans love, is that the lyrics are super relatable. So I think having some new and updated material on and seeing how else we can relate to them would be kind of cool. So I say keep with this band, just keep going.
So you're like, Blast Off really speaks to me. This is
Well, no, but what was that song? Blast off. Well, like I thought Coolidge for a while was cool, but She Don't Care, American, Dog and Pony Show. But I'm only reading off stuff from Cool to Be You. So, but yeah, I've been really getting into them, and I'm really looking forward to seeing them at It's Not Dead Fest in October. That's gonna be my first time seeing them.
John, what do you think here? Relevant old people.
Well, the Descendants are a great, great band. My favorite Descendants album will always be Milo Goes to College. I think it's their rawest, wildest, craziest, funniest album. I think once they started getting more of that polished sound, they lost a little bit of their specialness. I don't think this new album is going to be revolutionary. I don't think it's actually, let me take it back. I think the new album is going to be probably one of their better albums, probably one of their top three albums, if you will. But, I mean, the fact is they are older guys, and punk rock generally ignores the older guys or pays respectful reverence to them, but doesn't really like worship like the new thing they've done unless it's really radical. The new Descendants album is not going to be radical. It's going to be a very fine formation of what they've done before. So people are going to enjoy it, but it's not going to introduce the Descendants to a whole new class of people, unlike perhaps the recent Jeff Rosenstock LP or the recent Against Me LP did.
So that character we made up, like, what was his name? Tommy Microchip.
Jimmy Leatherbag and Tommy Microchip. But I forget which is which. No, that's right. Tommy Leatherbag is like a hipster. He won't care because they don't care about Descendants. And Jimmy Microchip just wants the next Falling Universe album, so he doesn't care either.
Well, fuck off both those guys. I mean, I'm looking at this and thinking that like they're more than any band of their era that's still releasing stuff. Descendants records still feel special to me. I mean, they don't seem like they have disappeared in a way that makes their reappearance a revival. It's not like, I mean, even though I love the new Buzzcocks stuff that's been coming out, you know, they went away for a few years. And when they came back, it was like, hey, the Buzzcocks are back. Isn't that weird? They're old people. And yeah, the stuff they released when they came back was really good, but there was that clear break in what was happening. And you came about this to compare that to say like Bad Religion, where they've been releasing stuff all the time and they haven't stopped. But that in a way that means, you know, a new Bad Religion record isn't as special because, you know, there's been like 45 of them and there'll be 35 more and that's fine. But you know, you don't have that. All the Descendants seem to be releasing stuff every 10 years at this point. And every time they've been doing it, it's been something that has been, you know, at least maintaining the high bar, if not really brilliant. I actually really, really like Everything Sucks, which was the 1996 record that came out. I liked it a little bit more than Cool to Be You. Cool to Be You felt a little bit too much mired in like George W. Bush era reactionary stuff that kind of all the punk bands around that time were doing. Like it sounds a little bit dated to me for some reason, but I really, really like Everything Sucks.
Yeah, I have a question though, because you guys are older than me, and I don't really remember when Everything Sucks came out, but when you guys heard in 2000, like let's say 3, that the Descendants were coming out with a new album after, 8 years, were you in the same place, or how were you guys thinking that it would sound like?
Having been on Punk News at the time when the last one came out, it was a big deal to everyone. Like it was. Being able to go and announce that a new Descendants record was coming out was it was one of those stories that we don't often get to write. Like, you know, it was a refused reunion type of story. Like one of those things where like, holy shit, you know, big important band that everyone loves that we don't get to talk about a lot is doing something. And now we get to talk about them. You know, it was the kind of story that was up there with like Lifetime playing a show again, or you know, if there's a Kid Dynamite reunion or one of those kind of things where there's, you know, these revered older bands that are getting back together and doing something then. I feel that it was a little bit less expected at the time. Like if American, which was the EP that came up before it, and shit, I'm blank, and Cool to Be You, those may not have happened, and if they wouldn't have happened, everyone would have just been like, you know, the Descendants were a band. I think this one is a little bit more expected. Like they were going to record something at some point. And that's, so this is less of a shock, but you know, it's still exciting to me. I mean, you remember too, like Everything Sucks came out in 96. So that came out like just a little bit after the kind of like Green Day, you know, punk into the mainstream explosion. So it was riding that a little bit, at least. I don't want to say it was an opportunist record or anything, but it, you know, it was definitely something that was released in the heat of that moment. So, you know, take that for what you'll take it for, I guess.
All right, cool.
These are huge spans of time.
Yeah, they are. I'm looking forward to this. I'm actually pretty interested to see where they go label wise. I'm ready to hear that. But why don't we move on? Andrew WK and Government Issue have been added, and also Belltones and Mean Jeans as well have been added to the bill to Fest 14. So let's see. We're sponsors of it, and people, other bands like Lagwagon, Nothington, Menzingers, Mustard Plug will be, and other bands will be headlining it. Fest 14, I'm not going. This makes me regret it a lot more now. Adam, what do you think about Andrew WK playing Fest 14? Is this the first time he's doing it?
This is the first time that Andrew WK, to my knowledge, has set foot in Fest. And actually, looking at a lot of the social media reaction today, I've got to imagine that that's the case, because it's been almost a joke that, you know, every year people are clamoring for Andrew WK to play Fest, and it was never really apparent that that was even, you know, something that would be on his radar to do. But for whatever, you know, funny reason, and I guess we should talk about this, you know, the punk community loves Andrew WK. So it was something that, you know, whenever we're coming up with like, hey, we have the greatest, you know, orgcore party going on right now, what was the one thing that it is missing aside from like more PBR and whiskey? And that answer is usually Andrew WK was the one thing that was missing from it. So, yeah, it's pretty big news. It's something that a lot of people have been hoping for a long time. And I don't feel like there's a lot of, there's not a lot of Fest gets that they haven't already got. And I think this was one of the last outstanding ones. I mean, you know, Fest has had their big Hot Water Music reunions. They've had Descendants play there. They've had Lifetime play there. They have Kid Dynamite the one year. I don't know.
Dwarves in great Dwarf style trashed the place and ended the set after 12 minutes, painted black in the truck shows that lasted 12 seconds.
Yeah, like a lot of the big bands that people were clamoring to like get back together and play Fest, or bands that were just like obviously should play Fest, but they're not a going concern anymore. Like a lot of those bands have got back together and played Fest. So this got to be one of the last major ones that was a holdout, at least. So yeah, it's pretty important. People seem pretty excited.
Do we know if this will be the full band, or if this will be, doesn't he do like solo shows too with like just like a, it's like a quote unquote, like kind of like a karaoke kind of thing?
He does a lot of weird stuff these days, and he'll do a lot of stuff that is not him with the band. He'll be playing the piano. He'll be doing Ramon songs with Marky Ramone. Although that would be pretty cool for Fest, but I've got to imagine that, you know, after finally getting him down there, it's going to be like the actual full Andrew WK thing.
I gotta say though, I've seen Andrew WK twice. I saw him with Marky Ramone, an awesome, amazing show. And I also saw him doing the solo thing, but it's not actually solo. It's him with two keyboards and a guy that looks like he lays drywall. And it's an amazing show. It might even be better than like a band show, just because it's so crazy, so energetic, it's so off the hook. I am not anti-Andrew WK at all. I think he's great fun. And so, I mean, I would think Andrew WK with a band or Andrew WK solo with the drywall guy is almost just as good. Like, if anybody watches Aqua Teen Hunger Force, his other guy looks like Carl from Aqua Teen Hunger Force.
Oh, God, I didn't know that.
I've not seen him in, oh, God, it's got to be like going on 6 years or so at this point. So
it's great fun, man. It is great fun.
Oh, it was great fun back in the day. So I would love to see this. I again am not doing Fest, so you know what are you going to do there?
But you punk news listeners should go see Fest. You should go. Oh, and I'll also point out that we had punk, we had Andrew WK on our mixtape before he was in Fest. Just saying.
That was the springboard that got him to to Fest, was being on our Low Run mixtape.
Actually, on a side note, is it's you know, I don't necessarily expect all artists to be cool in real life because they're artists. I am happy to report that Andrew, from my personal experience, Andrew WK and his business dealings are as cool and as positive and as awesome as the image that he projects on stage and through his different media presence. So that's always cool to know. He was super cool to me. Twice, super cool.
That's what everyone says. Cool. That's where everyone loves him. I'm going to divert here and talk about sort of like a weird Adam-centric story, but it's not even really an Adam-centric story. It's really one that appeals to like the Adam of, you know, what year would this be? 2004. And it's not a band that I've honestly thought that much about in a long, long time. So having to even talk about them on this show, let alone on Punk News anymore, is sort of weird. So we're talking about the Libertines here, which was a UK band that they released a couple records back in the early 2000s. They were lumped into the whole that whole rock revival thing that was happening at the time, when the Strokes and the White Stripes and, you know, and the Hives to some degree were all, you know, the bands du jour. And I, back in 04, back in 03, I really liked this band. And I'll get to that in a sec, because I guess I have to sort of justify it. But they've released a new video and, they've announced a new album. So there is a record coming out. It's going to be their first in a decade. It's called Anthems for Doomed Youth. It's going to be released on September 4th. And, you can find a link to pre-order information and everything on Punk News. So there is a video that is out for a song called Gunga Din, that appears on this thing, and you can find the full track listing, the cover art and everything over on Punk News. But the Libertines are, I guess the first question really more than anything, I don't really want to talk about this track too much because, to tell you the truth, this track isn't all that interesting to me, but was this a band either of you ever listened to? Like, were they ever on your radar at all? I mean, I'll explain how they got on my radar, and it's kind of weird, but, you know, have you heard of this?
No, I mean, and just judging by the song itself, this probably wouldn't have been something on my radar just by its sound, and just because it probably wasn't related to a lot of stuff that I do listen to and that I was listening to a long time ago. So this is really the story was the first time I really heard of them.
The only thing I really know about I know two things about the Libertines. I know that Pete Doherty is like one of the main guys, and he's like kind of like a modern day Shane McGowan, but not quite as bad. And I also know that Pete Doherty formed Baby Shambles, which was produced by Mick Jones, and that he loves Mick Jones of the Clash.
That's Doherty, I think his name is.
Pete Doherty, yeah.
Doherty, yeah.
Doherty.
So I'll give you my little weird history of me and the Libertines. And the reason why I feel like I need to justify this is this was a big band in the UK, and they were a big band in a way that we don't like bands to be big. It wasn't so much that they were popular and people liked the recordings and everything, cause they did, but it's that they, especially as like Pete Doherty basically, had like a very public drug problem. They became, tabloid fodder in the way that like the UK likes to treat a lot of their celebrities, where it was, you know, there was a lot that was said about the Libertines and about Pete Doherty in particular, and none of it was really about the band. It was all about, you know, someone's crazy drug habits and what was going on. So it was that became the story. So I think if you're from the UK, and I think we have some listeners over there, I have to imagine that at some point you became completely sick about hearing about this, and it was just the kind of thing that just struck everyone as, you know, gross celebrity gossip stuff. But here's how they kind of came across my plate. Back when I was in university, this would have been 2003 at this point. I was in the, you know, the local big chain bookstore that we had in town. There was a copy of Mojo, the UK magazine, sitting on the shelves. And this copy of Mojo, which I never read, had one of those, like, you know, they used to package, like, polybag the magazines and stick a CD in there. Well, this had a CD with it called Up Yours, Punk's Not Dead. And then there were like two classifications of bands that were on this thing. There was the then bands, and then there was the now bands. And it's crazy when you look at it these days and the line that they were trying to draw, because it makes really no sense at all that the bands that they were trumping as the now bands were the modern day punk bands. It makes no sense from the perspective of everyone in the States were not seeing these as modern day punk bands. And even in retrospect, it's totally weird. So like on the then side of the CD, you have 1977 by The Clash, One Chord Wonder by The Averts, Vic Goddard's Ambition, X-Ray Specs playing Identity, Johnny Thunders doing Chinese Rocks, True Confessions by The Undertones, Submission by The Sex Pistols, Orgasm Addict by The Buzzcocks.
That's a pretty banging track.
Search and Destroy by Iggy and the Stooges, yeah. Right?
That's banging.
Classic shit, right? On the now side of this Mojo 2003 Punk's Not Dead, The Strokes, The Hives, Hot Hot Heat, who else do we have on here,
so the Yeah Yeahs,
right?
The definition of punk is like the biggest radio rock bands there is at the time.
Well, it's weird, but then they had some on there that counted, like their now tracks were like this mix of the popular what were they calling it at the time, like new wave of rock, modern rock bands, and then some bands I would legitimately consider punk bands, but they didn't get the cover. They were buried in the track listing. So like, there was a Sleater-Kinney song that was on there, so that was kind of cool. There was there was something from the Hunches on there. So like the Hunches are an awesome, I don't know if they're around anymore, but the Hunches were an awesome band, but they were not a band that I would put in like the same category as the Strokes. But anyways. The Libertines were one of the bands that were on their now side of this this CD thing. And then they played a song called The Boy Looked at Johnny, which was off the first of the two Libertines records of that era. And it was, it was really sloppy in kind of a Pogues-y way, but also kind of clashy as far as how the music played out. And I really liked it. And I was really following the band's story for a while, at least from afar, and not being in the middle of all the UK press bullshit about it. It seemed like there was like a very kind of like tragic romanticism thing that was happening. And then when the band's second record came out, which was just called The Libertines. The first record was called Up the Bracket. I was super into it. And I wrote like the review to end all reviews of this motherfucker. You can find it on Punk News. It is, I review stuff rarely these days, but this story is like 8 or 10 paragraphs long of me analyzing lyrics and how much the lyrics have to say about blah, blah, blah. Like it was way more in depth than I've ever got reviewing, records, or there's maybe like 3 or 4 reviews ever in the history of me writing for Punk News that got to this level of like, verbosity. So I was just super into it, and it was really weird how much I was into it. Then the band broke up and they released a bunch of stuff afterwards. There was the Baby Shambles stuff, of course. There was then the other guys in the band went and formed another band called, I forget, but they were boring, and it all just kind of like eh. At that point, it was like, whatever, that guy's not dead yet? Oh, I figured he'd be dead yet. Okay. And now apparently they're all back together. I don't know what to think about it. The song didn't strike me as all that interesting or anything. It certainly wasn't energetic. So, I guess I'll check this out, but I feel so detached from it now that I don't really know what to think. I it was one of those things where, like, I was not expecting to have to talk about the Libertines ever again.
Do you think the music at the time was more about you than it was about the band? Like, do you think you're just associating a particular point in your life with having been a fan of that band, and that's why you're no longer attached to them now?
I think it was a point in my life when I had the luxury of being able just to dig into shit. So, like, this I would have been in like second or third year university at this point, right? Yeah. I'm like second or third year university. My girlfriend lives back home. I live in another city. So what do I do? I'm not out there trying to, meet girls or anything like that. So I'm going to...
Is that your wife now?
Yeah. So, okay. So I'm going to sit in my room and I'm going to, you know, listen to records, and I'm going to write way more than anyone else has ever thought about these things. And it was cool because, hey, there was a time when we carried punk news by doing that. And there was like three of us writing all the content for the site. But you know, I figure it just like, it was an interesting story that happened at the point in my life when I had time to make an interesting story my focus. So anyways, that happened.
Semi-related, Adam, if I may tack on to that. You know, I love the idea of like free sampler CDs that come with magazines, but I find like they only pay off like one out of every 50 times. Like 49 out of 50 times, the sampler CD, which you're excited to check out, is just a bunch of crap that you don't even want anymore. I mean, does the sampler CD have a function in real life? And now with the internet, does it even make sense at all?
Do people buy magazines still?
I love magazines. Magazines is my preferred reading format. I love music magazines. Glossy pages, cool pictures, in-depth stories. Magazines are still my favorite thing to read about music.
Like,
in England, they read them like crazy. England puts out 10 times as many music magazines as the U.S. I'm not even joking.
So I'm not saying that to be like snobby or internet-y or anything like that. It's just like I'm not at a point where I have like I don't see magazine stands anymore just because – like, again, like I did when I was a university student, I was walking through a mall a lot, right? But like,
do you not go to a supermarket, Adam? Do you not go to Staples?
I feel that like at least in our area, like our supermarkets are not big. Like the local supermarket to me, any of them that we go to, they don't have like big magazine racks.
Really, in America, supermarkets have tons of magazines. I'm not being like funny. I'm
like up here, you'd find them more likely in like a drugstore, let's say. Like, trying to think like what's your US equivalent, like
Walgreens,
like a Walgreens, yes. Or like a, yeah, yeah. Or a CVS or something. Like I was going to say like Shoppers Drug Mart, but that's a Canadian thing. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not in front of a magazine rack anymore. It's just something that doesn't intersect with me. So I don't know what's going on there. I know I have a bunch of friends that write for magazines and they all seem like very happy people. So I assume there's still an industry there, but, anyways, The Libertines, you should go back in time to 2004 and we could be really excited about them together. Ricky.
Yes.
Tell us about a band and then play us a song.
Okay, so real quick, we posted a story. It was an exclusive video from the class for this band called Class of 86. They're out of, I believe, Minneapolis. And it was a music video for their song called Phase Change, and their album Future on Fire came out in 2014. And and the album came out on Paper and Plastic, and I listened to the song. That was really good. And then I listened to the rest of the album on their Bandcamp. I went, what the fuck did I miss last year? I'm not kidding. For me, this would have been probably top five on my top 20 list had I known about this album back then. And I think the album came out like late summer, early fall. So again, the album is called Future on Fire from Paper and Plastic. This band, if you're into punk, but if you are also like metal and like that a Wilhelm Scream kind of sound, you will like this band. I'm not kidding. This album, and I think this is their second release. This album kicks ass. I'm going to have a review of it, I think, next week. Goddamn. So it's really, really good. So check it. You can see them on Facebook. They got their Bandcamp is Class of 86, just 8 and 6. .bandcamp.com. They're on Twitter. They're all, you know, typical places you can find them. So the song I'm gonna play off Future on Fire is called Vinny Vidi Vino, and I believe that translates to I came, I saw, I drank. And so again, here is Class of 86 playing Veni, Vidi, Vino. We'll be right back.
Well, at the very least, that means I came, I saw wine.
Yeah, but I'll point out that Ricky actually has never taken Latin, because in Latin, you do not pronounce V's as V's. You pronounce Latins as W's. I mean, you have pronounced V's as W's. So it's Wene Weenie Weeno.
All right, Elmer well, Fudd.
Yeah, Ricky.
So,
you idiot.
Just trying to show the punk music community an awesome fucking band.
Are you racist against Italians, Ricky? Is that what this is about? You hate Italians?
No, I love everything Italian. Believe me. That is really... Ricky, I love that culture.
You said that a little too enthusiastically, if I might say.
Because I had like the best Italian food last night. It was just fantastic.
Oh, you had Italian food. That's nice. John, he's calling us Dagos.
No, I don't hate Italians. That's no.
Well, Ricky, you're Jewish, right?
Yes.
I find the Italian and Jewish cultures generally have a lot in common.
They do. Yeah, I would agree with that. Also, because I mean, there are a lot of Italian Jewish people. I believe the Medici family was Jewish.
There's like no. I mean, I know there are Italian Jews, but there's not that many. Ricky, don't overstate it. Don't get your hopes up. Ricky's thinking.
Isn't like New York like? Can't you find a lot of them like in the boroughs of New York?
You can find a lot of Jews and a lot of Italians, but not a lot of Jewish Italians.
Interesting. I stand corrected.
Anyways, punk yeah. news.
Adam, you're Italian, but are you Jewish?
I'm Italian. I'm not Jewish. I've been told I look Jewish. I don't know what that means. And the guy that told me, and the person that actually told me I looked Jewish was way more Italian than I was. So at some point, I think if you identify stronger as an Italian, the way that you put down the lesser Italians is to call them Jewish.
I think that's racist in multiple ways.
It is. And that guy was a dick. So it all kind of works out. Let's talk about Leftover Crack.
Yeah, so let me delve into
this. Speaking of Jews that I like.
Yeah, exactly. Leftover Crack have finished laying down the recordings for the new album. I'm fucking stoked. I don't know about you guys. So according to some social media posts from Scott Sturgeon, the band has finished laying down the sound recordings for their next album. Presumably the tracks will still need to be mixed and all that stuff. But this will be the third LP, and it'll be the first one since Fuck World Trade. It's tentatively rumored, not really rumored, but you know, quote unquote rumored, that Mischief Brew, Bouncing Souls, and Blackboard Rom will be making contributions to the
Jesse Michaels too.
Jesse Michaels isn't listed here, but Jesse Michaels will be presumably on the album. Just an update for this. Apparently, Scott Sturgeon on his Instagram has been doing like saying hashtag Constructs of the State, so that might be the name of the album. And he kept saying like that it might, and he talked about how Fat Records might be involved. So those are a few little minor updates.
I think we know that Fat Records is going to be involved. I know they're on the next Fat comp, and I believe it's been announced that Leftover Crack is going to be on Fat. And if it hasn't, then I'd bet it will be, because the last SFH was on Fat.
Well, also the Fuck World Trade reissue was not. Yeah. Alternative Tentacles, and it was on Fat. So I think it's easy to assume that it'll be on Fat Records. Again, I'm fucking stoked for this. I am going to be seeing the band in August. I can't wait. This will be my third time seeing them this year. What about you guys?
Yeah, I'm hella stoked. I mean, this is one of my very favorite newer punk rock bands, and frankly, it is time for Leftover Crack to put out new material. I genuinely think Leftover Crack is one of the greatest punk rock bands of the last 15 years. I guess they're about 15 years old by now. Yeah. Or I think Choking Victim's even better, but Leftover Crack is great. Mediocre Generic is a mind-blowingly great album. But you know what? They've just been basically using the same, like playing the same material live since 2004, maybe a Deadline track here or there. But it is time for LOC to put out some new material. I'm super psyched. I'm loving the guest stars. I just can't wait to hear Jesse Michaels' Scott Sturgeon track, or a Scott Sturgeon, Eric Peterson of Mischief Brew track. I think it's going to be great. And, you know, too many guest stars can usually be a prognostication of the album's going to be crappy. But that's not the opinion. That's not the impression I'm getting here. To me, it's looking like just the right number of guest stars, and the album's going to be vibrant, exciting, have a lot of different sounds. I think it's going to be great. I'm really excited for this. And honestly, like I've said it like three times on the podcast, I am becoming a huge Fat Records fan. It seems to me, I don't necessarily like every record that Fat has put out lately, but every record that Fat has put out lately has maintained a certain level of quality that that certain audience expects, you know? So Fat really hasn't put out any duds in a long time. Agree?
No, I totally, I mean, that they're my favorite. Fat is my favorite record label.
Alternative Tentacles.
Yeah, they're up there with it too. Now, the one elephant in the room, though, and Adam, I'll let you give your opinion in a second, is no Ezra Kyer on this album, which
mean,
is a first.
You mean Kyrie? Ezra Kyrie?
Is it Kyrie or Kyer?
Ezra Kyrie.
Okay, I've only heard it. I've only read it, so I wasn't sure. Anyway, so Ezra will not be on. This will be the first album that Ezra will not be on.
I don't know why people are surprised by that, though, because it was announced that he left the band like 5 years ago.
It's not about the surprise. It's about what his contributions were to the other albums. I know Sturgeon wrote – he wrote all of Mediocre Generica, didn't he?
Incorrect. Ezra wrote a lot of it, too.
Okay. They covered Morning Glory's Gang Control on Fuck World Trade, which is just a leftover crack anthem now. Adam.
Leftover Crack has covered two Morning Glory songs. They also covered So You Want to Be a Cop.
That's right. They did. So Adam, what about you? Are you excited for this?
I'm interested to get back into this. I mean, I was a fan of Mediocre Generica when it came out, and I was, of course, I mean, we've talked so much about giving the boot on this podcast, but you know, I was a big fan of all the crack rock study stuff that was happening back then between them and Choking Victim. I never tuned in when Fuck World Trade came out, and it's always been something like I've heard bits and pieces of, but I don't know if I've ever actually made myself sit down and listen to it. And I don't know why. It's just, you know, sometimes bands just fly out of your orbit for whatever reason, and then it's kind of hard to pull back into it. But I'm excited for this. The guest stars look solid. Really like to sit down and listen to this thing, and I almost want to sit down and listen to this before I go back and redig into all the stuff that I've missed. I know it's not been a ton that's come out between then and now.
An album and a half.
It's been an album. Yeah, really. It's been an album, and then that Citizen Fish split, right?
And the F minus split.
Yeah. So like,
the F minus split is before Mediocre Generica, I think.
No. That came out in like 2008. It was like F minus and the Crack Rock Study 7.
No, you're wrong, Ricky. The F minus split came out the same year as Mediocre Generica, but they had to put out at the Crack Rock Study 7, not Leftover Crack, because they were under contract. That's what it is.
Oh, you know what?
I think it might have been recorded before Mediocre Generica, though.
You know why? I think it's because they reissued it in 2008 on vinyl. That might be why I'm getting it
wrong. I've got an OG 2002 press on vinyl, Ricky.
You're amazing, John. Adam, if I may recommend that you take a look at Fuck World Trade now, especially now because the reissue has some awesome, awesome new tracks on it. And some of them are old, obviously, but they're re-recorded. Two of them are re-recorded Choking Victim tracks. And then there's one featuring Black Dahlia of the Dwarves. It's a very cool...
later recorded as a Morning Glory track.
Really?
Yeah. The Black Dahlia track, which is called Do the Christ on the Morning Glory release. I forget what it's called, the Leftover Crack. Ezra wrote it. They recorded it originally for F World Trade, did not release it. They recorded with Black Dahlia. And actually, Ricky, in my interview with Scott Sturgeon about the album, it covers this. But then, since Ezra wrote it, he later released it on a B-side from the last Morning Glory album. Or no, the Morning Glory album before that.
No, that's the thing. Like,
Poets Were My Heroes, the 7-inch.
Yeah, it's that Born to December 7-inch. But the
flip side is Do the Christ. It's the same track, Ricky. Listen to it. I mean, it's a different sound recording, but I mean,
instrumentation is complete is much different than the one on Fuck World Trade. I think it's like the Jesus Christ Boogie or something like that. I say that in my review of the reissue too. And then someone commented on the reissue review that the Christ was actually a – let me click on it real quick. Hang on a second. The Christ is actually a cover song from Sturgeon's No Commercial Value band from like 1992.
Oh, that could be – you know, I had a chance to buy that demo tape once, and I didn't, and I've been kicking myself ever since.
That's one to get. But yeah, the Fuck World Trade reissue is, for me, that was like the – I think since I've been on Punk News, it's the only 10 I've ever given that wasn't – from like the 90s week that we did. It's fucking brilliant. I at least I think so.
I think it's great. I think it's a fantastic record too. Related, here's the issue with Leftover Crack that Leftover Crack cannot avoid is, you know, you listen to Choking Victim and you listen to Mediocre Generica, there's a great sense of whimsy and fun there. You know, they're singing about killing cops, they're singing about committing suicide, they're singing about doing drugs, and it's half serious, half funny, you know, because they were younger guys and they hadn't quite seen a lot of the, I don't know if tragedy is the right word, but a lot of the rough times they would see in the next decade. Now they're wiser, and pretty much all the Leftover Crack guys kind of write more serious, more darker songs, not quite as lovingly self-destructive. The problem is a lot of the fans went to ska stuff and the, you know, and the crazy self-destructive stuff like Gimme Heroin, like Suicide a Better Way, like Crack Rock Steady. Should the band write those kinds of songs? If they don't, will the fans dig the record even if they don't? I think the band is going to write a very dark, very heavy record without much of the crazy, whimsy stuff. I think it's going to be a great record, but I don't know if the fans that want the ska will love it as much as the kind of crazy, wacky, nihilistic stuff.
See, I'm not sure, because I mean, you saw them this year, and I did too, and the new songs they played, neither of them were ska songs, but they did... But he said, even announced before, he's like, this is the most poppy song we've ever written or something like that. And the other one was incredibly dark, not sounding, but the lyrics were that Leftover Crack brutality that I really love, really, really provocative, and just like, just, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, just like to the point and it was great. So the two songs I heard when I saw them live were really good and got me looking forward to this record even more. I hope it comes out in time before the end of 2015. That's my only concern. But I have a feeling Fat is going to do a really good job, especially pressing the vinyl.
Too. I think it will. I mean, they actually have just finished recording it this week. Fat rips records out pretty quickly. I think it'll be out around November.
Cool. All right, cool. So
let's get to one last story here before we get to our final song and wrap this show up. So the Queers, they're going to be re-releasing a record that I don't know if a lot of people were clamoring to be re-released, but I guess there's some interesting intrigue behind this. But so they've announced pre-orders for a re-recorded version of their seventh record, their 2000 album called Beyond the Valley. It's going to be called Beyond the Valley Revisited. And this is a full new studio recording. They went back in, they re-recorded all the tracks that were on this thing, and they're putting it out again. Now, this is only supposed to be limited to 300 copies, at least physically. It'll probably show up digitally, I'm sure. And you can go stream it on Spotify right now. This is interesting for a few reasons. I guess less so about the Queers themselves, although, like, I guess, like, you know, no slight to them, but I kind of wanted to talk about this story because I wanted to talk about bands re-recording their own material. And I guess that's an angle we could take on this. And another one is that apparently in this specific scenario, the band couldn't get the rights to re-release their original. Now, the original was on Hopeless, so I don't know what happened there. But so they couldn't get the rights and just did it again. But I don't know. It's an interesting, weird little story because you don't hear about bands doing this kind of thing very often. John, you wanted to talk about this one. How you want to approach it?
Well, first of all, the question is, why are they re-recording? They're re-recording because they don't have the rights to the original. So what he's trying to do is basically beat his competition. Actually, let me explain why this happens. A lot of the times when labels sign a band, they will purchase the sound recordings, but they will not purchase the underlying song composition. In the music industry, they call one the copyright and one the publishing rights. Law-wise, that's a very poor way to word it, but that's what the industry uses. So when the music industry says copyright, they actually just mean the sound recording. And when they say publishing, they mean the song composition itself. A lot of labels will just license or purchase or own the what they call the copyright, the sound recordings, not the underlying composition or the publishing. So what a lot of bands will do is they'll re-record songs to make it more available or to get the income directly to them. It's probably that Hopeless probably owns outright the entire sound recordings to this record. So Joe Queer wanted to, I guess, to cut in on that market Will he really? Probably. I mean, I don't think that many people are really buying this record. And according to his own website, he's only putting out 300 copies. Maybe he'll make like a digital version or something. But I don't even know how he can record an album for 300 copies. I mean, say he says profit is $10 a record, which probably more like $6 or $7. That's only $3,000. I don't think you can record an entire album for $3,000. So I just kind of think maybe it's poor business planning, unless there's something I'm not seeing. Also, I'll point out, as a fan, I'm rarely interested in these kind, like, it's just a straight re-recording of another album. I know Fear re-recorded their entire first album again. It's completely pointless. What I would much rather have would be a live recording, where maybe they play the whole album live, maybe they do some different things, and put in some rare or weirder tracks or just surprising things. Melvins have done that a lot. I love that. Who else have done that a lot? All the bands have done that too. The only band that I like where they just re-recorded, actually three artists I can think of, just did straight re-recordings of old material, but not albums. Johnny Cash re-recorded a bunch of his old material on American 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, and most of them are really, really great recordings. Peter Tosh made a habit to re-record his old material. The reason he did that was because basically a lot of the songs were only available in Jamaica, so by recording it for an international audience, it's really more of a question of distribution than it is cutting out a former label. And the Dwarves album, How to Win Friends and Influence People, is a re-recording of their greatest hits, essentially. So it functions as a greatest hits, and it's just a great, it sounds like a live record even though it's studio, so it's just a great record. So I kind of think these things are pointless. It's generally, it's an artist just trying to make a little bit more money off his own song composition. I don't know if Joe Queer has thought this out financially, unless there's something I'm missing, which maybe I am.
Yeah, I wasn't sure about this either. I mean, until what you said about them getting the rights if they re-record it to their songs. So, I mean, only 300 copies. I mean, you would think like that's pretty much just like a reissue.
Yeah, but not like he can't make any money off that. Like, if he only pulls
I know, but
you know,
I know, and I listened. And originally, what I thought what this meant was, because I don't follow this band that much. I listened to some of the stuff. I just streamed some of their tracks on this album, and it didn't, like, I thought it was like they were re-recording it for like quality reasons. It was recorded fine, and 300 copies seems like not a lot, unless what they're planning on doing is jacking up the price because it's only 300 copies.
He's only selling for $13, which is entirely reasonable. You know, so maybe he's planning on making a lot on the digital sales, you know, like maybe he's going to flood iTunes with it. But I mean, are that many people really buying digital versions of Queer's albums from 2000? I can't imagine he would sell more than, I don't know, 100 copies, you know, per year. I don't know, man. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I'm still confused about this thing. I mean, I understand, like, to get back the songs, but I mean, what's the end game here, you know?
Maybe he's just doing it purely for the sake of art. It could be.
If that is, I mean, yeah. I wonder if the pre-order thing says anything else. And it... Oh, with hand-screen cover artwork.
Well, that's cool.
That's something interesting. I mean, like... I mean, unless, like, I wonder if it'll be, like, hand-numbered. Sometimes fans do that, too. I don't know.
But wouldn't you much rather have, like, a live album where they just play the whole album live? At least that way it's unique from the other version. You know what I mean? Like, this is, like, when a band re-records an entire album, such as when Nico did, it's never – I can't think of one instance where a band re-recorded an entire album and the re-recording is better. I'd much rather have just a live album. Which, and actually, when you think about it, a live album kind of makes more sense because – hardcore fans will buy the re-recorded album, but most people, if they already have one album, they're not going to buy the other. But the hardcore fans will still buy a new live album, and more people will probably buy the live album than the re-recorded studio version, you know?
Yeah, and I agree with that myself. Like, the problem is that whenever I hear a new studio version of a song that I have heard a previous studio version of, it to me does not at all matter if the new one is technically a better recording or whatever. It sounds weird to me.
There's the magic isn't there. Like, the reason you love the original track is there's some unquantifiable magic in there, and when you re-record it, it's much more workmanlike.
Yeah, there's that, and I think there's just, like, there's, you know, when you record anything, there's little quirks that kind of work themselves into that original recording. You know, it might be the way that you hit a note when you're singing a certain, you know, verse, and it's not really part of the song. It's not even really something you try to reproduce live or anything. It's just how it came out. And then when you go and record it, well, that's not going to be there anymore necessarily. And it's so that, yeah, that stuff always sounds weird to me, but I would never think that if it was a live track. And so, yeah, I don't know. I'm not quite sure about this one. I don't quite know what's going on here.
Could it also be that they're just doing this partly for because the 15th anniversary of the album being released was like in May?
Probably it's possible, but he's also re-recording another album too that he doesn't have the sound recordings to. So I think it's a business decision. But even if it was a 15th anniversary, doesn't it make more sense to do a live album than a re-recording of the studio version?
It would also make more sense for him to be selling more than 300 copies too.
I hear you.
I mean, if they go on tour, they'd probably sell plenty of those.
Yeah, I've seen the Queers once, and they sell their fair share of merchandise.
Yeah.
So I think he could probably sell it out, unless maybe he's going to print up like 2,000 copies after the initial 300 sell out. Who knows? You know, I mean, if he sold 2,000 copies, that's 20 grand. He can make a profit there. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just baffled by this, honestly, baffled. So I'm trying to figure some kind of reason for it, and my only go-to reason is a financial one. You know.
We will probably never know on something like this, so I guess that's the best that we can do. It is super weird, though. I mean, it's.
I have one explanation actually, and not to keep bringing up the Dwarves. One time before I even knew Black Dahlia, I asked him, Black, why did you re-record all those songs for How to Win Friends and Influence People? And he said, it's if a movie wants to license the studio recording, he would sell his cheaper than the other versions that aren't owned by him. And so the Dwarves versions are pretty close to the other versions, and they're pretty good sounding. So maybe Joe Queer is just hoping a movie's going to pick up one. Because, you know, when you license a song to a movie, that's boku bucks. We're talking anywhere from 10 grand to 200 grand. Like, you get boku bucks for licensing a song to a movie. And so maybe Joe Queer is just hoping that will happen. That's why he's doing this.
Yeah, I'm sure the person that farms out music for movies is looking for the 7th Queers record.
I mean, look at it this way. Hangover 2 had an exclusive Danzig song. That's kind of weird, right?
Yeah, but that's Danzig. I mean, there's...
Yeah, not the Queers. I mean, Danzig is more famous than the Queers.
I don't want to sound like I'm shitting on the Queers here. I'm not really expressing any kind of problem that I have with the Queers. It's no, more...
You're purely objective. The Queers have far fewer fans than Danzig.
Yeah, it's just... It's an odd duck sort of thing. But hey, people have their reasons for doing this stuff. I'd be curious about really, and this may be something you could write us at podcast@thepunknews.org to tell us about, is that like, if you're a Queers fan, like, are you into this? Like, aside from the collectability reason of getting like the hand silkscreened, whatever.
Including the collectability, like maybe that's the reason.
Or maybe that is it, yeah. So anyways, let us know. podcast@punknews.org. We're going to play one more song before we get out of here, before this baby that is sleeping at my feet wakes up and tries to destroy everything, before John gets arrested in front of a Panera bread. What we want to talk about here is I want to talk about a band from Vancouver, BC that we haven't heard a lot about in the last few years called Carpenter. Now, we were a bunch of us, and when I say we, me, Brian Yancey, Brian Schultz, a bunch of us that were kind of older school punk news people, we were really into this band's last record that came out. It was called Sea to Sky. It showed up in 2010. Not the greatest record in the world, but a really interesting sort of record. The band has a little bit of... I've said it once on this show already, so I hate to say orgcore, but you know, there's a little bit of some rough hewn, you know, earlier Hot Water music, you know, emo before it became like a really ugly word worked into their sound. But a lot of their songs were about farming. They were about this kind of like rural lifestyle, and maybe they fit in a little bit more with the sensibilities of like fellow Canuck acts, the Weaker Thens maybe. Than say some of the No Idea bands. But anyways, Carpenter had a record came out called Sea to Sky 2010. It was pretty cool. The band hasn't really done anything since then. But now they've released their first song in 5 years. The song itself is called Songs on the Stereo. It is a tribute of sorts to a friend of the band named Tim Squid McGinnis, who died. He was a member of a Vancouver band called All State Champion, which was a super local Vancouver band. But if you heard of him, that's where Tim was from. And he was a friend of the band and a big supporter of theirs. So they've dedicated this song out to him. It's going to appear on the band's new record, which is going to be called Lifelines. And it's coming out in fall of 2015, presumably released by the band, because I haven't really heard any sort of label that's attached to it. But anyways, here's a new song from Carpenter called Songs in the Stereo, first in 5 years. So check it out. That is it for the Punk News Podcast. Guys, we had a lot, a lot of obstacles for this show that seemingly didn't blow up. So,
yeah.
Hey, except
my computer's running low on juice. It's raining. I'm sitting outside a Panera at 10:21 p.m. I was pretty sure I was going to get thrown out or arrested at least, but here I am, safe and sound. Knock on wood.
We can only hope that when I stop this recording, the recording didn't work. So that'll be the capper. Anyways, if this recording worked, we'll see you guys next week. If not, no one will ever hear this. So there you go. See you later.
Later.